Your City, or something like it, is an anthology of fiction stories, each inspired by a specific location in New York City. For more episodes, and for information on how to submit your own story, visit AIEA's website at aeaea.co. And now we take you to a diner on 9th Avenue, between 43rd and 44th, for Vagabond Shoes by Abby Wilde.
The story you are about to hear began when I first came to New York. I don't just mean when I stepped off the bus from Virginia at Port Authority a couple of weeks ago, although yes, technically that's where everything really takes off. But if I'm honest, the bigger story, the story of this whole podcast, began the day my ancestors first came to this city 175 years ago. If the Abrams family hadn't stepped off the boat at Ellis Island in 1847 with their eyes fixed on Lady Liberty, I might not have grown up here. I mean, not physically here. I actually grew up a couple of states away in a semi-rural Virginia backwater, but still, I lived in New York. It was the starring character of all of my favorite books and movies and, yes, musicals. I mean, New York is the wilderness where all of our modern folk heroes go to test their mettle and meet their monsters, you know? You make it there, you make it anywhere. It's a melting pot of aspirations and agonies, the cradle and crucible of the American dream. A place where an enterprising journalist, like myself, can hopefully find a good story on every street corner. I'm Stevie Abrams, host of what I hope will become your new favorite podcast. Welcome to the very first episode of Once in NYC, a weekly deep dive into New York City's lesser-known myths and legends. And like I said, we'll start with the one I walked into my very first day in town. I'm calling it These Vagabond Shoes. Get it? Told, it was actually about 20 minutes between the moment I stepped off the bus at Port Authority and the moment I found my way out to 8th Avenue. If you've never been to the Port Authority bus terminal, just picture your basic labyrinth of old chrome and concrete bouncing the sounds of 100 irritated tourists back at you while you try and fail to navigate an endless maze of wrong escalators and dead-end platforms. It can be especially frustrating when all you really want is your first look at Broadway. I know, it's corny, but it was my first time in New York, and I couldn't wait to drink in the sight of the city lights, the symphony of the taxis, the intoxicating odors of every single food cart. But I forgot all about those things the moment I got my first glimpse of him. This homeless man standing right in front of the statue of Ralph Cramden outside the bus station. He looked 65, 75, something like that. He was absolutely filthy, caked in dirt, yellowed hair, giant gaping holes in everything he was wearing. But underneath all of that, he carried himself like a gentleman. Like Jay Gatsby by the pool. There was something very astute about him. Not that homeless people can't be astute, but it's hard to describe. He just seemed, I don't know, so present. So still. So focused. That's not really why I stopped, though. What stopped me were his shoes. They were beautiful. A pair of classic men's wingtips in warm brown leather. The craftsmanship was incredible, like something out of an artisanal workshop in Florence. And they looked untouched. No dirt, no scuffs, like they'd come off the workbench that morning. I don't think I normally spend a lot of time looking at other people's shoes, but these ones drew the eye, as if they were illuminated by some inner light. They were like him. Out of place. Present. Focused. And while I was staring, trying to match this derelict aristocrat with his immaculate shoes, I noticed the sign. He was holding this tattered piece of cardboard upon which was scrawled the following: "Buy my shoes. Serious offers only." I had to know more. I also had a pitch meeting with Sidecar Studios later in the week, and, as it happened, I had a field microphone in my pocket. Excuse me.
Yes, miss?
Yeah, miss is fine. You're selling your shoes?
Absolutely I am. Wanna buy them?
These shoes, the ones you're wearing?
That's what the sign says.
Is this like a gimmick or something? Like, you want money for beer or whatever, but you're going to say you're selling your shoes.
No gimmick. Just the shoes. Genuine vintage leather, hand-sewn uppers, and the laces have never gone loose on me once. Hand to God. What do you say, kid? Want to buy them?
I don't know. Think they'll fit a women's 7?
Might do. I run petite. Come on, give me an offer.
What's the catch?
A catch?
Yeah. If they're so perfect, why are you selling them? What's wrong with them?
Smart girl. The catch is, they've got a story.
Is it a good story?
That very much depends.
Depends on what?
Depends on what you do with it, I guess. You want to hear it, or would you prefer to stand here criticizing my sales pitch all day?
Yeah, I want to hear it. Over lunch, I'll buy.
I never say no to lunch with a pretty girl. Lead the way.
Once I lived the life of a millionaire, spending my money now, did not care. Count my friends, out for a good time, buying bootleg liquor, champagne and wine. Lord, but I got busted and I feel so low. Didn't have no money and no where to go. This is the truth, Lord, without a doubt. Nobody wants you when you're down. I mean, nobody wants you when you're down.
He led the way, actually. He took me around the block a bit to this seedy-looking diner on 9th Avenue, just off of 44th. It wasn't bad. I mean, it wasn't like a New York diner from the movies or anything. You know, Gene Kelly dancing in the back, Meg Ryan orgasming in the front. But they had a big menu with everything on it. And they didn't seem to mind us camping out for a while, which was important. Something told me this would take some time. There we go. All set. And once again, just so I can have it on the record, do I have your permission to record this conversation for public broadcast?
Whatever you like, miss.
Thanks.
You said you're a writer?
A journalist. Well, independent audio journalist. I'm launching a new podcast project, and I have a pitch meeting later this week, so this is really lucky, actually, bumping into you.
How do you mean, lucky?
Well, this is exactly the sort of story I'm looking for. I couldn't ask for better material.
Uh-huh.
Sorry. No. I didn't mean that you're... I didn't mean to make this about me.
It's fine. Please. I don't mind being material. I used to work in radio, too.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. Well, not journalism, though. I wrote radio plays. Ever hear of The Shadow?
Yes.
Me too. Good show.
Oh, you're funny.
Lisa got that going for me.
All right, we should begin, I guess. Let's start with, can you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Caleb Leonard Conrad. I was born in Fleming, Ohio in 1921.
1921, but that would make you, what?
98. Look all right, don't I?
I hope I look that good at your age, sir.
Isn't hard. It's just my luck. You want to start there, the whole David Copperfield treatment?
No, let's start with what brought you to New York.
I came to the city in 1939, just when it felt like the whole country was catching its breath in the space between a depression and a war. I had lived my whole life on a farm in Ohio. And by 1939, there were two younger brothers and a baby sister keeping me company. Baby Emily was barely old enough to plant potatoes, but my brothers were both nearly grown by then, 12 and 14, so there wasn't much sense in keeping another mouth to feed around the farm. Not that I'd been planning on sticking around anyway. Far as I was concerned, my future lay in radio. All my life, I'd lived and breathed for the moment when night would fall and we'd all gather around that radio listening to spine tinglers like The Shadow and Alias Jimmy Valentine. Ma nearly sold the thing after War of the Worlds, but that's exactly what lit my fuse. It was lights down, curtain up, act one of the rest of my life. I wanted to be the next Orson Welles. After all, he wasn't much older than me. Who knew? So one day, I kissed my sweetheart, Kitty McFarlane, goodbye, promised to send for her once I'd got settled, and came to New York with a suitcase full of scripts and a portable typewriter my uncle had given me for my 18th birthday.
Mr. Conrad started knocking on doors that very afternoon, beginning with CBS, the home of his idol Orson Welles and the birthplace of the War of the Worlds. But Mr. Welles never had a reputation for sharing the spotlight. CBS turned him down flat, and his luck wasn't much better anywhere else in town. Door after door slammed in his face, and 3 weeks later, he was no further ahead than when he'd arrived. So what did you do?
What could I do? I got a job. And that was lucky. There weren't many to go around. Kept trying to churn out scripts in the evenings and make the rounds to the radio offices on my lunch breaks, but no matter what I did, I couldn't seem to make an impression. That was a lonely time for me.
What about your girl back home? Wasn't she supposed to follow you out here?
Well, I wasn't about to bring her out to see what a failure I was up close. Not that she would have seen it that way, I think, but I wanted to impress her. I wanted to give that girl the world.
What was she like?
Kitty? She was... she was a dreamer. Maybe a bigger dreamer than me, even. Warm nights, we used to sit out on the roof of her barn, where her mother could see us from the kitchen window, you understand? We'd sit there, counting the stars and telling each other stories of what it'd be like when we moved to the big city. She used to tell me we'd meet all her favorite stars one day. Joseph Cotten, Joan Fontaine, Van Heflin. And I'd tell her that I'd write play after play for all of them, just so she could have them over to tea at our three-story penthouse whenever she wanted. Bringing her out to New York, asking her to marry me before I could do any of that, it'd be like breaking a promise. And just then, I couldn't have imagined breaking a promise to Kitty McFarlane. So I left her in Ohio for a while. I sent letters every week, money when I could, and focused on writing and working in the store.
What kind of store?
The shoe store kind of store. Morelli's shoes and fine leather goods. A dark, dusty hole in the wall that smelled like shoe polish and did more work in repair and resale than in new shoes. People would come in and sell their best church shoes for milk money. Maybe come buy their shoes back after payday came in. You don't see places like that anymore. It's the kind of business that only thrives in a depression.
Well, I'm pretty sure pawn shops are still alive and well.
Well, sure, but you ever see one that deals in something so personal as people's shoes? You just can't. Nobody's in a rush to pay for something someone else has been laying all their weight and sweat into month after month. You just couldn't find the customer for it. And believe me, I've tried.
In fact, I tried too. I tried to independently verify as many details of Mr. Conrad's story as I could, beginning with this one. I still haven't turned up any mention of combination shoe repair and secondhand stores like Mr. Conrad describes in the archival material I consulted for this piece, nor could I find any record of a Mr. Morelli at the address specified by Mr. Conrad. There was a shoe repair service listed at that address in city business records from 1948, but it belonged to an Archibald Johnson. Mr. Morelli remains a ghost. Actually, records of the address are pretty sparse from 1979, following the death of Mr. Johnson and the closure of his store, until it was bought, renovated, and reopened in 1988. As a diner. You mean this used to be Morelli's?
You didn't think I brought you here for the food, did you? Of course, it wasn't so big as this in those days, you understand. They must have knocked through the haberdasher next door and the automat on the other side of the block to make all this. But before all that, the counter was right over there by the hostess stand. There was a display of Mr. Breen's fine shine shoe polish right about where you are sitting.
Wow.
Yeah. Been coming here at least once a week since. Anytime I could afford the price of a cup of coffee. The coffee's shit, but it's worth it to have some place to go back to. One afternoon, it was a Tuesday, I remember, because Mr. Morelli wasn't there and I only ever worked alone on Tuesdays. A man came in to sell his shoes. These shoes, actually. The ones I'm wearing now.
This was still 1939?
40. I'd been working there about a year by then.
Mm. And what did this man look like?
About 40, I think. Blonde hair with a pink, piggish face. And boy, was he nervous. He kept mopping his brow and looking over his shoulder like a snitch in a gangster movie. Couldn't for the life of me figure out why, but then of course... I didn't know then what I know now. Wish I did.
How do you mean?
I'm getting there. He was in an awful hurry to sell, and the odd thing about it was he didn't give a damn what I paid for them. I could tell they were expensive, the shoes, I mean. They were better looking than anything I'd ever seen in the shop before. And I tried to tell the man to come back tomorrow when the boss was in, but he wouldn't hear of it. Kept begging me to take him. Please, please, sir, you gotta buy him. You gotta. I was only 19, remember? Nobody had ever served me in my life. And here was this man treating me like I had the power of life and death in my hands for buying these cockamamie shoes. I told him I wouldn't know what to pay for them, that the boss would know how to give him a fair price, and he said, I don't care about that. I'll take a penny if you got one. Which was fairly magnanimous of him, considering I couldn't spare a dime.
Didn't that make you suspicious?
Terribly suspicious. But I couldn't for the life of me figure out why he'd want to get rid of them so badly unless they were, I don't know, evidence of a crime. But that sort of thing only ever happens in yellow paperbacks, nickel pictures.
Radio thrillers?
Radio thrillers, yes, ma'am. The way I figured it, maybe the fellow was just nuts. He wouldn't relax until someone bought his shoes, so me buying them would be almost like a good deed. And after all, I did have a penny in my pocket. So, I put the penny on the counter and bought the shoes.
Just like that?
Well, I tried to write him a receipt, just in case he changed his mind or Sam Spade came around looking for a nervous murderer selling men's wingtips, but he took off out of the shop before I could finish. So that just left me in these shoes. I put the clothes sign on the window and put them under a magnifying glass to get a closer look. Don't know what I was looking for. Blood, bullet holes, didn't matter. The shoes were spotless. Beautiful. Looked like they'd never been worn before. I needed a pair myself. Almost seemed ashamed to sell them. And anyway, I'd practically already bought them, hadn't I? The penny come from my own pocket. The shop had barely had a thing to do with it. Why, there wasn't even a paper trail. They were mine already. Trouble already started, you see.
If I say what trouble, will you tell me?
Probably not. It'd ruin the suspense.
Well, we wouldn't want that.
No, ma'am.
So you kept them?
Mm-hmm.
Was that when you put them on?
That very moment. And they fit perfectly. As if they'd been made for me, and I knew exactly where I wanted to go with them. I closed the shop early that day and walked straight to the CBS office with the secondhand carpet bag I was still using for a briefcase at that point. Walked straight into the front office and slapped a script on the secretary's desk.
What was the script?
A little horror called Storm Warning. A farm boy gets a hold of a ham radio set, uses it to fake a news broadcast that says the world is going to end. His parents get spooked and take him and his sister down to the storm cellar and go nuts from the fear. They end up killing the kids to save them from the apocalypse.
Jesus.
A little grisly, maybe, but CBS seemed to love it.
But they bought it?
Yeah. It was sort of uncanny. Used to be, the secretary would have dumped anything I gave her on a stack of manuscripts 2 inches from the trash can, waved me out the door, and that would have been the end of it. This time, she told me she'd put it on Mr. Richardson's desk and even asked me to make sure my address was on the front. Good thing, too. They wrote 2 days later, offered me $40 for the story. And what's more, they asked me to send around whatever else I had. So I sent the whole works back with the messenger, all 13 other stories I'd been peddling over that year, including 6 which they'd already seen and rejected. They bought them all.
Just like that?
Well, only 6 at first, but they picked up the rest of them after my first couple of scripts went to air. Guess my stories were pretty popular.
Why the change? Why do you think they took a chance on you?
Why do you think? Only thing I changed was my shoes. I figured they were lucky.
Well, they certainly got your foot in the door.
Oh, You're funny.
I try. My research suggests, though, that Mr. Conrad had more to thank than just his shoes for his warm reception. For one thing, CBS was scrambling to fill their dramatic programming while head writer Orson Welles was out in Hollywood with his newest vanity project, codenamed RKO-281. They were only too eager to find an ambitious kid like Mr. Conrad to fill his absence, and Mr. Conrad rose to the opportunity.
Pretty soon, I was writing full-time.
And how did that work exactly?
What do you mean, how'd it work?
You know, describe an average work week. For my listeners, did you have an office?
Oh, yeah. I had one. Corner office. My name in golden letters on the door.
All right. I was just asking.
And I'm telling you, they really gave me one. Not right away, of course, but after they'd aired their third story of mine, about a month in, they called me in for a meeting, offered me a contract. That was the day I quit the shoe store. From then on, I was CBS exclusive property, for radio, that is.
Which meant what, exactly?
For your listeners?
Yeah, paint me a picture.
Meant a weekly paycheck of $150 so long as I wrote 2 usable scripts for them per month. Usable meant they liked it, you understand, and lucky for me, it seemed they liked everything I threw at them. Every Monday morning, there'd be a big meeting between the staff writers and Mr. Richardson. He was the interim director of radio drama. Us writers would pitch whatever we wanted to work on that week, and Richardson would say yay or nay. And you didn't want to bore Mr. Richardson. If he turned down a pitch or if you didn't have anything, you'd get stuck with an assignment. usually a book. Literary adaptations were big in those days. If you weren't careful, you'd be stuck in a back office trying to break The Magnificent Ambersons down to 1 hour. So I made sure I had something to sell every week. High literature was not my forte.
What was?
Thrillers, of course. Monsters, murder, anything that'd keep someone up all night on the edge of their seat.
Can you remember any of your favorites?
Oh, certainly I can. The Scarecrow, Mama Feeds the Pigs. Of course, I always loved Storm Warning best. Maybe just because it was my first hit, but you know, it was a classic setup. The Boy Who Cried Wolf with a technological twist.
I guess thrillers were pretty popular back then, huh?
Thrillers are always popular. It was a good gig. Every Monday, me and my lucky shoes would walk a new script through the door and walk away with a fat paycheck. And then I'd spend the week sitting in on recording sessions, watching the magic happen before heading home to write the next one.
Still wearing those lucky shoes?
Ooh, always. Not entirely on purpose, you understand. I tried to buy others, along with suits, cigars, a grand piano. I rented a fancy apartment uptown off Amsterdam to put it all in. But for some reason, whatever looked right on me in the store felt wrong on me in the morning when I reached into the closet. I just didn't feel right walking out the door without those shoes on.
Was it superstition?
I think it was more like humility. Made me feel like I was still the earthy farm boy I'd always been. And I still felt like one. All that success coming so fast, I hardly knew how to trust it. I just celebrated my 20th birthday. I thought someone was going to call my bluff any minute.
How do you mean?
I thought that sooner or later someone was going to figure out that I had no idea what I was doing and that I was making it all up as I went. And as soon as that happened, they'd put me on an express train back to Ohio. You could almost say I was
waiting for the other shoe to drop. We walked into that one.
I couldn't resist.
No, of course not.
No, but that's how I felt. Even when they were painting my name on the door, I couldn't believe I'd really made it. So, of course, I couldn't send home for Kitty yet, not until I knew it wasn't all about to slip through my fingers.
Did you... I mean, you did want to marry her, didn't you?
Oh, yes, I did. Of course I did. I missed her terribly. There wasn't a moment I didn't think of her. She was in everything I did. Used to sit on the roof of that apartment on Amsterdam and make believe I was back on the roof of Kitty's barn, staring straight up at the stars until the buildings disappeared. Used to write up there, too. Dangling my legs over the edge like an idiot with my Uncle Ernie's typewriter on my lap and half a cup of cold coffee next to me on the ledge. Never could finish a full cup. Story would get a hold of me before I was half done, and off I'd go, holding on to the tail of a comet streaking across my brain. And then, sometimes, the story wouldn't come, and I'd talk to Kitty until it did. In my mind, you understand. I'd make believe she was there, remember what made her eyes shine, what made her smile. She had a wicked smile. She always loved it when I put characters in trouble. I'd tell her all the best bits of what I was writing. Imagine what she'd ask, where she'd get bored, where she'd want to go next, until I knew how to tell the story. And away I'd go until sometime after midnight, when the word stopped coming, Kitty was gone, and I was alone on the rooftop again. God, I missed her. I just wanted to wait to bring her to the city until she could be proud of me.
I'm sure she was.
Well, I know she was. But I didn't want her to be proud just because she loved me. I wanted her to be proud because I was a god. See the difference?
Yes, I do.
Stupid of me. Should have married her as soon as I got that corner office. I think I would have been a happy man if I just had the good sense to stick with radio, but I kept waiting for my next big break.
And then you got that big break.
How did you know?
Sounds like that sort of story.
Smart girl. As a matter of fact, I did. See, I got tired of the grind of a new idea every week, wanted to see if I could make something stick, something with staying power. So I threw together a little weekly adventure romance for the 5 o'clock show. A little serial adventure called Mrs. Malloy Investigates.
A housewife turned private eye?
Got it in one. Something to fill the gap between Nancy Drew and Miss Marple, know what I mean? Turned out, it was a popular draw, a bigger hit than any of us predicted, and one of my biggest fans was Mr. Richardson's wife, Eleanor Liebschein, of the Broadway Liebscheins. Oh, sure, you've never heard of him, but back then, that name opened doors up and down the Great White Way, and Mr. Richardson wanted to make good with the in-laws, wanted a shot at the family throne. All he had to do was put his money into a surefire show, so what did he pick?
Mrs. Malloy Investigates.
Yes, ma'am. Except he threw a composer, a lyricist, and Sunshine Slater into the mix.
And who was Sunshine Slater?
Well, a star. An absolute star. Or anyway, she should have been. That woman was one of a kind. Mae West's Moxie with Myrna Loy's legs. She was a real artist, too. She could play anything, switch from ingenue to femme fatale on a dime, and the pipes on her could have blown down the Statue of Liberty. A real star. Smart broad, too. She charmed the pants off me from day one. I was still a gullible, earnest kind of kid and still waiting for the imposter police to come bang down my door. But when we were introduced, that first rehearsal, she lowered her eyelashes, called me Mr. Conrad, if you please. Well, felt like I grew a foot right then and there. She made me feel like Mr. Conrad, made me feel like I deserved that Broadway credit, that apartment on Amsterdam, that corner office, made it all seem real.
How'd she do that?
Well, she was beautiful, which helped. And she listened so well. She was full of questions, wanted all these details about her character's history, things she said only I would know, things I'd never considered before she made them real. And answering her questions made the story bigger and more complex, which made me feel bigger and more complex. Nobody had listened to me like that for a long time.
Not since Kitty.
Wish I'd put that together as fast as you did. By the time I caught on that she was flirting with me, it was too late.
So nothing happened between you and Sunshine?
Oh, it happened all right. I just wish I'd seen it coming. Might have had the sense to get out of the way. Mind, she had to hit me over the head with it at first. Invited me back to her place after rehearsal one night and came to the door bare as the day she was born. I caught on quick after that.
So you...
Yes?
You just slept with her that night.
Is that so hard to believe?
I don't know. A minute ago, you were an idealistic farm kid stargazing on the roof and dreaming of your girl back home, and now you're...
An idealistic farm kid gazing at an angel who made me feel like a god.
And that was worth having an affair?
It wasn't an affair. I wasn't married yet. I wasn't in love with her or anything, and Sunshine never said she wanted anything serious, so there weren't any feelings in the mix. Just fun. And she taught me things. But I told you, I couldn't propose to Kitty until I felt like a big shot, and Sunshine made me feel like a big shot for 4 glorious weeks.
And then what happened?
I called Kitty to set a date, and Sunshine and I called it quits a week before the wedding. And it was a beautiful wedding. I was proud of that. Brought Kitty to town in style, first-class sleeper car all the way from Columbus, just like in the movies. When the train rolled in, I was there to meet her, wearing a brand new tuxedo and my lucky shoes, all polished up to a high mirror shine. I walked her straight into the main concourse. You been there yet? You have to go. It's the most beautiful place in New York City. We walked into the Grand Hall. The Mrs. Malloy Orchestra was playing Here Comes the Bride, and a Justice of the Peace was waiting to marry us next to the Central Information Booth. We had Sunshine and Eleanor for bridesmaids. They threw flower petals at us while the crowd cheered. We had our first dance in front of the whole city of New York, under a sky of painted animals and incandescent stars.
And what happened next?
The honeymoon suite at the Plaza.
Well done, you.
Yeah. I was real proud of myself. Thought I'd made a clean getaway. Sunshine and I had made a clean break with an amicable understanding. Like I said, all fun and no feelings. And we covered our tracks well. No way Kitty could have found out what we'd been up to. And anyway, it was over. Everything had tied itself up perfectly.
Except it hadn't really. Had it, Mr. Conrad?
How do you know?
Sounds like that sort of story.
No, it hadn't. Pretty soon, I was a wreck.
Why?
First week of married life wasn't what I'd imagined. Kitty wasn't the girl I remembered. Or anyway, she wasn't the girl I'd been talking to in my mind for all those months. After she'd caught me up on all the doings at home, we ran out of things to talk about. And that was day one. We were shy, barely knew how to talk to each other, let alone touch each other. Sex was... I was afraid to touch her. Thought I might muddy her up, break her somehow. She seemed very breakable. And she seemed perfectly content with things the way they were, which made it all worse. And meanwhile, Sunshine was ignoring me. Well, not so much as anybody'd notice, but she wouldn't talk to me unless it was part of her job. Which is what I wanted, of course, but I went from thanking my lucky stars that she wasn't making things difficult for me to tearing my hair out over the fact she'd barely said two words to me in 2 weeks. I'd begun to feel small again, like the imposter police were breathing down my neck. Felt like my world might end any day, and in the middle of all that, the show opened.
How was that?
Oh, we were a hit. Hell, we had 5 curtain calls. We were royalty. Mr. Richardson had us all out to Sardi's for an after party. The champagne and the flash bulbs should have put me back on top of the world, but I still felt like a fraud. Sunshine didn't look at me, and Kitty couldn't even see me. Oh, she was there, pinned to my side, clutching my arm and grinning through the flash bulbs, but all she could say about the show was that it was very good, dear. I thought about taking her up to the roof, just the two of us, where we could stare at the sky until the words came back, until we could explain ourselves to each other. But there was so much I couldn't explain.
You were feeling guilty about Sunshine.
No. I wasn't good enough to feel guilty. I felt persecuted. Already I looked at Kitty and felt like maybe she was better than me, or I was better than her. I was more sophisticated, but she was better. And no amount of explaining myself to her would make that go away. We'd never match again. So instead of sneaking out to the roof with Kitty, I snuck back to the theater with Sunshine. Well, you can guess the rest.
Kitty caught you?
Hmm.
How?
It was after midnight. She'd come looking for me so we could get a car home.
No, I mean, how did she find you two?
Well, there was this bedroom set for the Act Two love duet between Mr. and Mrs. Malloy with a king-sized bed on stage. We, weren't exactly inconspicuous.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay, so what happened next?
What do you think happened? She screamed, we screamed, and Kitty ran off into the night while I was still pulling up my pants. By the time I made it out to the street, she was long gone. I thought she'd caught a taxi home. I told myself there wasn't any point in talking to her while she was that upset, that she'd be far more reasonable after a cry and a sleep. So I fixed my tie and went back to the party with Sunshine at my side.
Wow.
Look, you don't have to tell me it was the wrong call. I knew it was. And not just because of what came after. I knew then. When I'd been seeing Sunshine, I'd felt on top of things. I'd felt like royalty. I wanted to go back to that. Everything had been so easy before. I still sort of believed everything would be okay in the morning. Everything I'd touched had turned to gold, so why not this? You know?
We can piece together what happened next from archival copies of The Times. Kitty Conrad approached the information desk at Grand Central at approximately 1:30 a.m. Her feet were bare and bleeding, and she held her party shoes in her hand. Authorities theorized that she had walked the mile between the theater and the station. She asked the man at the counter when the next train would be arriving, and upon his information, she bought a ticket and proceeded to Track 15, where she patiently awaited the 2:34 from New Haven. As it finally screeched into the station at 2:36, she removed her gloves, unpinned her hair, and stepped off the platform into its path. Mr. Conrad knew none of this until hours later, when the police invited him to identify a body they'd found carrying his wife's purse. The papers for October 3rd, 1941 show a dazed Mr. Conrad stumbling out of the morgue. The headline reads, "Grand Central Tragedy. Kitty Conrad Takes Life."
Should have known. Should have known she'd take it so hard. I should have chased her all the way to the station, begged, groveled, done anything to keep her with me. Bought us 2 one-way tickets to Ohio right that minute. Not that I could have. I didn't know that then.
Did you go home for the funeral?
Didn't even try. I thought, well, I told myself I couldn't get away from the theater, but mostly I was afraid her father would have shot me on sight. Which he would have. I sent flowers and a check to pay for the services, which the McFarlands returned, uncashed. I ended up giving the money to Sonny to redecorate the apartment with. She moved in, you see.
That quick?
2 weeks later. See, here's where I really screwed up. I did the same thing schmucks like me always do when they hit trouble. I ran away from it as fast as I could and tried to fill up my life with noise and success. I was, after all, C.L. Conrad, wunderkind writer of Broadway's latest hit. Kitty might be gone, but that didn't mean I wasn't invincible, you know. It was just one problem.
What's that?
Sordid tragedy's a killer for ticket sales.
I can't fault Mr. Conrad for his optimism. It must be hard to imagine crashing back to Earth when you're soaring towards the sun. The voice that's missing in all of this, of course, is Kitty Conrad's. She was so much more to Mr. Conrad than a tragic accident. She was so much more to the world. I wish she'd known how much. But as it turned out, the loss of his young wife was only the beginning of Mr. Conrad's troubles. But we'll save that for next week on Once in NYC. Hi, this is Abby Wild. I'm the writer and one of the voices of These Vagabond Shoes. If you or someone you know is having suicidal thoughts, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or go to suicidepreventionlifeline.org. The world loves you and we want you in it.
These Vagabond Shoes was written and directed by Abby Wild. The part of Conrad was played by Pat Dwyer. The part of Stevie was played by Abby Wild. This podcast is an IEA production. This podcast recorded at Brooklyn Podcasting Studios.